Everybody, and welcome to True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am here with my pal, Stephen S. You can find him on True Stories of Tinseltown. Facebook, you know, and he's here. And he loves his pre-code, and he knows his pre-code, and he loves his Toby Wing and Kay Francis. Hello there, Stephen. Welcome.
Hello, Grace. How are you? Good to talk to you again. I'm shocked that you're having me back on, but you know, sometimes it once bitten, twice shy is usually the rule. But you know, that's what you want to do.
I love having you on. I had so much fun the first time, and you were so great. And now we're going to do another one, and I know it's going to be fun and great. And we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. First off, Stephen suggested that we talk about me seeing the newest Star Is Born and comparing it, right?
Yeah, I thought that, because I think that's something, even the people who know that I'm a classic movie fan and who have no interest in classic movie fans have asked me, what do you think about that movie? Because they all know that it was based upon a lot of them think it was based upon just the Barbara Streisand movie, or even some of them know the Judy Garland, but a lot of people don't realize it went all the way back to 1932. So, I think it would be interesting to talk about that and sort of talk to it as a couple of classic movie fans, you know, what we thought about it.
Yeah, and as you said, 1932, people said the first Star Is Born was actually What Price Hollywood, which starred Constance Bennett and Lowell Sherman, and he discovered her. He was drunk as a skunk, and she was a waitress at the Brown Derby, and he took her to a premiere. Then he said, I'm going to put you in a movie, give you a part. He forgot because he was so drunk, but she did not. And lo and behold, she became a star. America's pal.
America's pal. I think the thing that is interesting about that movie is, one, is that Lowell Sherman's character is not her love interest.
Nope.
She actually falls in love with Neil Hamilton, who is a polo player.
Yeah. Ick.
And was sort of a womanizer character. But also in the movie, he really, he literally pulls her from being a waitress through the process of becoming a star. He was a producer. He was not a movie star.
And also a director.
So he, when she went to go get that film test that he promised her, and she was rehearsing for it and was botching it up, he was the one that sat down and told her, look, this is what you need to do. You know, approach it like this, look like this. And, then when he got the test back, he sort of snuck it in with some rushes on another movie to get in front of some of the big wigs to really get her career started. So he was much more of a
mentor. He was her mentor, and he was also her best friend.
Yes.
And she protected him. He was on the wane because he was so drunk and so unhappy and so sad. But she was always there for him, regardless of anything he did. She just was there. And then Neil Hamilton, being the stiff that he is, didn't like him being around her and their child, and he wanted to take her to court to child custody. And it was just sad because Lowell Sherman knew he was doing things that were hurting her. She was going to protect him at all costs. And then he shoots himself in her home, which was horrible. And that's basically how Star Is Born was born.
But they changed it. Yeah, and the idea was at the end was that they, you know, after his death, then, you know, her life was scandalized because the press was talking about how this, you know, this guy died in her house and what happened. Did she shoot him? Did you know, Neil Hamilton shoot him? And
was he her? Were they involved in an intimate way?
Yeah, were they lovers and those kind of things?
Yeah, and innuendo up the wazoo. And so I liked the movie a lot. I liked What Price Hollywood. I thought Lowell Sherman was amazing, quite frankly. Yes. He did such a wonderful job as the drunk and very sad guy.
Right.
Who was
and I think Cukor was the director of that. And he actually for a 1932 movie, he did a lot of very creative things. I mean, he did some montages of her to sort of move the story along as she started her career in an upward climb. You know, there was a scene where she was practicing walking down the steps for her rehearsal, and he showed her feet moving up and down and up and down, showing how much effort she was putting into rehearsing. So, yeah, it was a very good movie. You know, I don't know if I would have seen that and then seen the later movie in 37 with Frederick Marsh and Janet Gaynor, if I would have necessarily tied the two of those together as closely as they were.
No, because it wasn't really spoken about at that point. And, you know, I saw the new Star is Born. And I've seen all of them. And the Janet Gaynor one, I have to be honest, I've loved all the men in all the movies. Janet Gaynor, to me, and she was huge in Silence, but she is this really little woman with a Mickey Mouse voice or Minnie Mouse voice. And I just didn't get the charisma that she was supposed to have to be this big star. Frederick March was fabulous.
Yes.
And I just didn't like Janet.
You know, my feeling was, first of all, you know, I think that role is sort of the ingenue, the female lead. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to start as a sort of a little mousy type of character, you know, and then you evolve into, you know, it's almost like, you know, growing into a swan, and at the end, you know, you're this, you know, self-confident superstar.
Right.
And you know, I think Janet never, in my mind, she never really made that transition upward. And then, but then compare that to Barbara Streisand, who, in my mind, never had the attitude at the beginning of being sort of the ingenue, you know, innocent, trying to make her way in the big world. She sort of, from the very beginning, it was like, you know, I'm in charge here.
Right.
And you're like, you know, and so to, you know, her metamorphosis, if you will, didn't make sense either.
Although I loved Kris Kristofferson and he broke my heart. I mean, I cried my eyes out as I did, you know, when I saw the one with James Mason and Judy Garland. This was her big comeback. Did you see how Lorna Loftus wrote a book about it? And
I saw there was a book. I haven't really seen any excerpts of it or anything.
Yeah, I'd love to get Lorna on. And I found that movie, and I'm going to admit, I'm really not a musical lady. I will fast forward. I love Judy Garland's voice. I love The Man That Got Away. It makes me cry. Yeah. It's such a great song. But it was Judy's showcase. You know, she was just there. Judy's showcase. Yes. I thought James Mason was amazing. It was offered to Clark Gate. Who? Cary Grant. He didn't want to become the fading star. He didn't want to do that.
Right. But and a lot of the Humphrey Bogart, a lot of people
turned it down.
And you know, the line is that they didn't want to be a fading star. I think a lot of them also realized that, you know, they were just going to basically be holding Judy's coat, which is what James Mason did. I mean, you know, James Mason didn't get very much screen time. His character really didn't get a whole lot of development. And the same thing happened to Kris Kristofferson. You know, I remember I was actually working as a projectionist when that movie came out, so I remember it very well. And the thing that always got me is Kris Kristofferson never sang a song all the way through in that movie. And this is a guy who's a singer by profession, singer-songwriter.
Well, he's more of a songwriter, because his singing was not really anything that you want.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he's a country singer, so
right.
By definition, you can be a country singer and not sing in key.
Well, so, especially so, Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
I thought he was hot, though. I really did.
Oh, yeah, and I think a lot of people. And that goes the whole thing about, you know, it's a movie where the male lead has to sort of start being as an attractive figure and end up being, you know, sort of on the skids. So it's a movie that really requires both parts. If it's done as something other than, you know, like you said, Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand turned it into really their vehicle.
Their showcase, and, right.
Their showcases, and you know, the male lead was there to hold their coat and to, you know, be a foil for them.
But to me,
on their movie,
I love the men. I didn't like Judy as much as I liked Mr. Mason, and I did not like Barbara as much as I did Kris Kristofferson. I bought it. I cried when he died. I cried when James Mason died. I cried when Frederick March did.
Frederick March.
And half hour into the newest Star is Born, I was crying because I knew it was going to happen to Bradley Cooper. I loved him. He was gorgeous. I am not a Bradley Cooper fan. His job, he directed. He learned how to sing. He was hot. He looked at her like he really loved her. There was something missing in that film. I don't know what it was. Gaga did fine. You know, I don't think she deserves the Academy Award for it, but she acquitted herself very nicely. But there was something missing that just, I don't know. You know, like the other women were like tiger women for their men, and she was not. And she has some pipes, I gotta say. She's so talented. And she looked amazing with her regular hair color, very pretty. But Bradley Cooper, he blew me away. And of course I cried.
Well, you know, the thing is Bradley Cooper is, you know, in quotes, a professional actor.
Right. I mean,
Bradley Cooper is probably sort of his generation's, you know, Tom Hanks or, you know, Clint Eastwood or somebody like that who, you know, can actually, you know, has the chops to act. And that's rare. I mean, a lot of actors are making a lot of money by running around in hero costumes and standing in front
of a
green background.
But
actually able to act where, you know, the thing about that movie is at least for me, is 5 minutes in the movie, I forgot I was looking at Bradley Cooper, and I'm thinking I'm looking at Jackson Maine. Or whatever.
Oh, you saw it too?
Was. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw that movie. Sure.
What do you think?
The new
Gaga?
One?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I got to tell you, my feeling about her before I saw the movie is, you know, you see so many of these stars, you know, Madonna and other stars who, you know, they become pop stars, mm-hmm. and they become pop stars by wearing their underwear on the outside of their clothes, shaving their head,
or,
you know, wearing a meat dress.
Yeah, that was Gaga and bleach blonde and the whole nine.
And being outrageous. And then once they achieve, you know, stardom or popularity there, then they say, well, you know, I want to be considered a serious performer. And, you know, that's been Madonna's situation since, you know, 1990. She's been keeps on telling everybody I'm a serious performer. And, you know, that was the case with Lady Gaga. And I'd heard her sing. When I heard she was selected, I went, ooh, because I'd heard her sing with Tony Bennett several years ago. And, you know, she's trying to sing American Standards, which is not an easy thing to sing. And her voice seemed a little thin, and, you know, she just didn't seem to have the range. But then I heard her in this movie, and it's obvious she's been working very hard in the last, you know, several years, because she blew me away.
Yeah, her singing is amazing. Ability. And I love the song, The Shallows. Oh, my God. He sang it, and then he had her come out. Didn't he look at her with love, though? You could see with those beautiful blue eyes. I believed he was madly in love with her. I wasn't so sure that she was madly in love with him, and she kind of gave up on him very quickly. I thought there was something, I don't know, like a couple of scenes missing until the end. How did he die? I mean, he took pills and then he passed out. Did he have the car and gas running, or did he die
from
an overdose?
No, he hung himself.
Oh, he did?
He hung himself. Because and that was flashed back when he was in one of those therapy sessions. He said that when he was like 13 years old, he tried to hang himself from the ceiling fan, and all he did was tear the ceiling fan down.
Huh.
And that's what it was. In fact, if you know, and I've only seen it the one time, but if you watch, you know, they show a pan away from the garage, and you can see through the windows of the garage, you can actually sort of see his body.
Oh, I didn't see that because I was crying.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing that got me, and I thought, you know, again, I be honest with you, you know, I thought I was going to, you know, being a sort of a cool classic music or movie fan, I thought, you know, I was going to sit here and poo-poo it and tell how terrible it was. I really liked it. My only complaint about it was I thought that after about two-thirds of the way through, it started to really drag. It started losing momentum.
Yeah.
By then, she had been a star, and he was on the wane, and they were trying to figure out some way to show that. And, you know, they start showing him in, you know, rehab, and they started, you know, and it just
to me,
the
it didn't
just
work.
Sort of
there was
off.
Something missing there. That's how I felt from her being his girl to her being like doing those stupid dances in the mirror and the orange hair and her manager. And with Bradley, I just felt there was something missing. All of a sudden, you're ruining me. That really didn't go with the other women. You know, they didn't. She was hard ass and said, and it just, to me, maybe it's because it's updated to now, but.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, it's a different world than what it was in 1937, 1954. Because you'll remember one of the sort of climactic scenes of those earlier movies is when Judy and Janet stand before a crowd and say, you know, good evening, I am Mrs. Norman May.
Or like Esther Hoffman Howard, you know, with Babs.
And to have, you know, I think she said something like, you know, my name, she went by just the name Allie, and then she goes, I'm Allie Main. And, you know, it just didn't have that sort of reaffirmation that no matter what, you know, after he's all he put me through and everything, I'm still, you know. He's still the love of my life. That didn't come through.
I didn't buy that. I agree with you. I'm 100% there with you because that, you know, even with Babs, it came through with that. And like I said, I've loved all the men. They might not have the largest part, but I thought, you know, Bradley Cooper learned to sing, and he did.
Well, I think he had by far of all the movies, his part in this movie was by far the largest.
I thought
Lady Gaga, I was not a fan of hers before then. You know, I sort of went in there, I don't say expecting to be disappointed, but not being surprised if I was disappointed. And I was very, very pleased with her performance. You know, I think you can pick things apart, but, you know, I think if I was going to rank it, I would say it was better than the 76 version. You know, 54 was such a Judy Garland vehicle, it's hard to even compare it. You know, there wasn't the large production numbers, you know, that you had in the Judy Garland. You know, you had some just, you know, huge, you know, musical numbers, you know, it was like watching Oklahoma or something.
Right. And even, you know, when so he's going to his death, he says, sing a song for me. It's like, shut up already, Judy. You know what I mean? I'm going to my death, and she's belting out a song in the bedroom. And I'm like, is that really how I want to go to my death? Or is this driving him to his death?
Yeah, maybe he's trying to make sure.
Shut up. Left. Yeah. So I was like, it always makes me. But with Lady Gaga, she did a great job. Andrew Dice Clay was in it as well.
Yes. And he did a nice job.
Yes, I didn't recognize him at first.
I didn't either.
And Dave Chappelle was in it. And Robert De Niro's daughter was in it. She played Dave Chappelle's wife. So it was an interesting film, and I liked it. I haven't been to a movie in ages. My friend said, "Let's go." And it was an afternoon movie. It was a great theater, and there was probably about 12 of us in this humongous theater. It was fabulous.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, here, I have some trivia for you related to it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, and this has been known by a lot of people, early on when Lady Gaga is working in that restaurant, mm-hmm. she's walking through the hall and she's singing to herself the preamble, the start of Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Hmm.
You know, like little happy little bluebirds fly over front.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, that. And then this is the other one. This is one I discovered, which I don't think anybody, I haven't heard anything else about. You know, the initial scene of the new version, Bradley Cooper, you know, inadvertently walks into a drag bar.
Right.
And, you know, full of, you know, cross dressers. And, you know, that's where he discovers. And you go back to What Price Is Hollywood. Lowell Sherman, in the scene where he meets Constance Bennett at the Brown Derby,
mm-hmm.
he's walking through the restaurant, and you see him bump into it looks like a very, you know, slightly built man with a suit and like a fedora hat,
mm-hmm.
and the person spins around and you realize it's a woman.
Oh, I remember that.
Cross-dressed as a man. And Lowell Sherman's smart ass remark is, "Oh, you'll have to introduce me to your tailor." So in both of those films, 85 years apart or whatever the math is, you had a similar type of situation with, you know, things which, you know, I guess the guy shows you nothing's ever ever new under the sun.
True. And he was so cute. I'm sorry. I'm swooning over Bradley Cooper. I've seen how he looks now, and I'm not swooning anymore. But as this guy, I was like, hubba, hubba. And honestly, those beautiful blue eyes and the way he looked at her, it was so convincing. And
like I said, he's a professional actor. I mean, in my mind, he's up there at the very top of his profession. And, you know, he performed on Broadway too. So I mean, you know, if you're out there on a Broadway stage every night, you know, you learn
you're
to be
pretty naked.
Actor.
Yeah, you're pretty naked.
Yeah,
every
night. And that's why a lot of the stars in the 30s who went from Broadway to the talkies, you know, I think that's why a lot of them were so good actors, is because they came from that stage, and every
theater,
night you got to be on
NYC. Yeah. Yes,
right.
But he was great, and Gaga was good. I enjoyed the movie.
And I'd recommend anybody that's a classic movie fan, if you've seen the other ones or if you haven't seen the other ones, to go see it.
Yes, I do too.
I think it's well worth. And you know and what's really nice is it's actually a modern movie that didn't have any car chases or building explosions.
Yes,
so,
or superheroes,
you know.
or any of that stupid crap.
Yeah, no gunfights.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it just was a nice movie.
Yeah.
And I like the songs. I like the whole nine yards. I thought there was one scene that they did do an homage to. Did you know that John Peters was one of the producers? Did you see that?
He was the producer of this 1976. He was Babs'
babe. He used to be a hairdresser, and he was Babs' dude, and he's the one who gave her that horrific, horrible perm that she wore for years and years and years.
But he
produced that. They wanted Elvis.
The Harpo look.
And Elvis wanted to do it, but Colonel Parker didn't want him to do it. And Kris Kristofferson did it, and I thought he was like, meow, growl, yowl. Yeah, he was so cute.
Yeah.
And like I said, I like in all the movies, I liked the men better. I liked Bradley better than Gaga, but she did a good job. I had seen her, because I do, I have to admit, I watch American Horror Story. And she was in American Horror Story, but it was all about just style, that she was walking through and looking cool and not really acting. So she did a good job. Do I think she deserves an Oscar? Do you? Do you think she deserves an Oscar for this?
You know, first of all, the Oscars now are so political that it's hard to make any kind of prediction on it.
Right.
I don't know what kind of competition she's going to be facing. If I had a vote, I'd give her a nomination at least.
I'd give her a nomination, but I wouldn't let her win. I would get Bradley Cooper probably as best director because he acted, he sang, and he directed this flick. So I think I would give him best director. That's my thing. And I agree 100% with Steve that if you love these movies, this was a good one to see. I'd love to know. Wouldn't you love to know their opinions? So go to True Stories of Tinseltown. I do have a group, and it's only Steve and I. But you can try to find it, or I'm trying to let people post on the page and let us know what you think, because I enjoyed it. I was glad I saw it. Bottom line.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you. I think that a lot of times some of these older movies, when they get remade, as a classic movie fan, you cringe. But I thought that they did it there. Bradley Cooper's the guy that's the creative force behind this thing. I
mean, he was amazing.
He's the one that drove the boat and got it done. And he did a hell of a job.
And really cute did. As a friggin' button, people. Right. If you like those beautiful blue eyes, sort of greasy long hair and that beard. Oh, I was talking about the sort of homage because John Peters was producer as well. They did the bubble bath scene. They did, showed the, what do you call it, motorcycle, other things like that. And I was like, wow, that was in this movie or whatever. So I think.
Right. Yeah. And there was also some flashbacks to the 54, because remember Lady Gaga went to makeup and they were trying to fix her nose. And he ended up saying, what are they doing to your nose? Your nose is beautiful. And that's actually in the Judy Garland one, too, because remember, she gets all made up and James Mason makes her scrub her face and takes, like a prosthetic on her nose, like a rubber thing on her nose. And he tore that off her nose. So
they were saying she had a little nose.
Yeah, they were trying to sort of build her. They were trying to build her nose up.
Did you know that that's what Orson Welles did? He used to wear prosthetics on his nose because he thought it was too small.
Really?
That's a true story from Tinseltown, kids.
Yeah, really, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
did not know that.
Yeah, and then and it was amazing. I read this article from this woman who said that. You know, he was objectifying and he just touched her nose without her permission. And I'm like, oh my goodness, he just touched her nose once because she mentioned that people thought she had too big a nose. Right. And I'm like, my goodness, you're writing this article about this? I'm like, honey.
First of all, is when you talk about performing, your looks are part of what you're selling. Mm-hmm. So it would be like if someone is selling widgets or a car or something, you're going to touch it. You're going to make sure you're going to check it out. He's really doing it for purposes of trying to determine what was best way for her to go forward with her career.
But he also thought she had a cute nose, and she does. I thought she looked.
Well, it's sort of funny because that's one of those things. You know, the whole early beginning of that movie really was written around sort of Lady Gaga's early career. Yeah. Because, she started in
little clubs, you know, in the village.
Started like little drag bars. That's why she's always been sort of an icon for that community.
Like, and all then those also, women are, like Madonna and all those women. Right. Yeah.
And then also, you know, one of the things that she came across, and people, a lot of people said her nose was too, you know, she wasn't attractive enough. Her nose was too big or whatever. And so that, you know, so a lot of that stuff is, you know, real true life.
Yeah, but I don't see it. Things. I thought she looked beautiful.
I did too. I thought she was, in the very beginning there.
So pretty.
I thought she was very, yeah, she's very pretty.
Yeah, until they get to the orange hair and all of a sudden she starts doing those stupid dances. And he's like, what? Yeah, so I, you know, I just, I don't know. Anyway, watch it. I think it's good. So we're going to go now. We're going to jump off and we're going to pre-code stuff.
And we're going to do a little bit of sort of a, this is sort of a, this is a fun thing. This is sort of a, you know, what if you and I got to be the official kings and queens of the Oscars and we got to decide who got what and for what movies, and sort of looking at the Oscars from the perspective of people in the 21st century and what was given to the Oscars.
30 and 34.
Oscars.
Yeah.
30 through 34.
Because that's
which
pre-code.
Are the movies, which are all the pre-code stuff. And you remember the code kicked in, I think it was like July 1st of 1934.
Yikes.
So we're going to look at those years starting 1930 through 34. Now the thing that's a little funky about the Oscars for a portion of that is they eligibility was based on like a half year, so it went from like, you know, July 1st of 1 year to or August 1st of 1 year to July 31st of another. So for instance, like the 1930 awards were for movies that came out August 1st to 1929 and then July 31st to 1930.
Who knew?
And the problem, you know, and the thing is like all the lists that I could find were all listed them based upon years released and the calendar release year. So for purpose of what we're doing, we're not going to deal with that.
No.
So we'll just look at it from basis of a calendar year and just sort of go from that.
Yeah. So 1930, the winner was All Quiet on the Western Front. And I have to say that movie touches me to this day. It is an amazing movie for to not be pro-war.
Pacifist? Yeah.
Pacifist. Yeah. And
right.
It's an amazing movie, and it shows you the horror of war. And it was funny, you know, because Lou Ayres would go there, you know, he went back to Germany and his father and all these friends are debating the war, yet he's there in the trenches and he literally sees his friends die, they take their shoes, they take whatever, and they even have breaks from the war. Remember that? Where you could just be like friends with the person who is going to try to kill you and you're going to try to kill. It's so obscene, and it's just a wonderful film that I don't think I could pick another better one for 1930.
Well, you know what I did is I went ahead, you know, and I sort of looked at these and said, well, you know, I'm gonna go and I'm not gonna I'm gonna pick a movie, I'm gonna pick an actress, and I'm gonna pick an actor, and I'm not gonna be based it all upon
Hollywood,
you know, what Hollywood tells me, and I'm going to look at it with modern eyes. I'm not going to try to predict what I would have picked in 1930.
Right.
So my best picture nominees for 1930, you know, and again, All Quiet is excluded, is The Divorcee. It's Norma Shearer.
Did you see it?
Yes, I have, and it's a very good movie. Very good movie. Blue Angel. With Marlene Dietrich.
Yes.
German movie. I think that's an excellent movie. And then I had Hell's Angel, which was the movie it had Gene Harlow in it. It was Howard Hughes bankrolled it. And, you know, it was a World War One movie. And then also Dawn Patrol, which was another World War One flying movie. That one had Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Richard Barthelmess in it. So those were my four nominees. And the one that I picked as being the best movie for 1930 of those four was The Divorcée.
I have to agree, because that was a very, when you think about it, and I love the scene when she goes into the kitchen. Janice, to me, is the grossest woman Ted could have ever had an affair with. She's just this, like, sluggy, gross, short, enormous short, but she was even shorter. And I love when she comes in. Norma comes into the kitchen, and Janice goes in because... the husband's supposed to be making drinks or whatever. And she said, "We have guests who are only thirsty," meaning, you know, they ain't horny, they're thirsty. Right? And it was so great.
That's what I said.
Yes. And it's just really funny. And then, like, Ted, it doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't mean a thing. And Norma, of course, is irked, as well as she should be. And Ted is like some stupid galoomph who doesn't catch a clue. And then Norma ends up having a one-night stand with Robert Montgomery, who is Ted's best friend. But, of course, Norma has to come clean, and she tells him, "You know, it doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't mean a thing." And then he says, "Listen, you." And he it means a thing. So Norma says, "My door is closed to only you," you know, when they, because he's such a baby about it.
Right.
But the thing I find funny about Norma Shearer movies is she plays spunky and like a man. And she, but she always crawls back to the guy. And like, she takes Ted back.
And that's something I think you see as a you see that in a lot of pre-code movies, you know, where women are given a little bit more independence and a little bit more you know, ability to get away from what sort of social norms are. They can get away from what the social norms are, but the audience, which is, you know, made up of a large extent of women, are sitting there and want them to come back to, you know, hearth and home at the end.
Yeah, but with
so
some
I think
of these
a lot of that
creeps.
Has to do with it.
But
oh, I know
creeps.
It's terrible. You know, we talked about that in some other movies where it's like, you know, she's got a choice between her creepy husband or her jerky boyfriend, and you're right. Like, you're like, none, you know, how about none of the above?
Really? Yeah, so. Because like Norma, in she was a big star in The Silence as well, but she was never a femme fatale. They to cast her. She was married to. What was the kid? The kid
Irving Thalberg
Jr. And
yeah.
She was not a femme fatale in Silence, and she wanted that part in The Divorcée, but they never saw her as, you know, a va-va-va-boom vixen. And she had pictures taken, and they sold it. And Norma, she could sell
and she's
it.
Not, and she's not, you know, and I, you know, she's not a classic beauty.
No, she's cross-eyed.
Yeah, she's got, you know, and you know, that, and that's one of the things I find endearing about some of these leading ladies is that they're not perfect. I mean, they all have like little, you know, it's sort of like Kate Francis got that lisp, you know, it's just, there's like a, they look beautiful, except there's just one little thing that sort of, you
they're
know, makes them human, makes
yes,
them human.
Exactly. And she did a wonderful job, I thought, in The Divorcée. And, I'm glad
she won. And she won the Academy Award for Best Actress. So when I looked at the Best Actresses for 30, you know, again, she's out of the picture. So I picked Greta Garbo and Anna Christie. I've seen it. And one of the things, too, is 1930, there was not, you know, a lot of the pre-code movies that you and I enjoy watching were really more 33, 34, 32, 30 and 31. It's a little, yeah. It's a little thin.
Because it's like weird. The best actor in 1930, winner George Arliss, Disraeli. I have no idea. I've never seen that film.
Yeah, Disraeli was the prime minister of Britain during the 19th century. So it's probably some kind of a biopic.
Yeah, never seen it. And
but for the actresses, I had Garbo as Anna Christie, Marlena Dietrich for Blue Angel, and Joan Crawford for Our Blushing Brides. And then, boy, you know, just throw a fourth one out there. But Kay Johnson and Madam Satan.
Did you see that? I don't like
that
movie.
That's a weird movie.
You know, he's such a creeper husband. It's like, why are you trying to woo him? He is so bad.
Well, but I think that she was trying to test him by sort of making him not see what he would do if he didn't realize it was her. But anyway, I gave that one to Marlena Dietrich because I thought that Blue Angel, I think, is an excellent movie. The best actor thing, again, you know, some of these movies, you know, really, it's sort of funny when you look at these pre-code movies, the male parts aren't very deep. I mean, there's only a few really good parts in some of these movies.
Well, The Big House was good.
The Big House was good. I didn't care. I'm not a big Wallace Beery guy. I don't know. I've heard too many stories about him.
Meanie. I liked Chester Morris in that. And also,
Chester Morris is good.
He was great in Precodes. And also who was in that was Robert Montgomery as this stool pigeon. He was a bad boy. And I don't know. I don't get the George Arliss because I've seen him in other films and I.
Yeah, he never made much of an impression on me.
Yeah.
I actually my best actor one. This is probably a little squirrely. I picked just because you know again looking back at it from my perspective, I picked the Marx Brothers for Animal Crackers. I think their comedy's iconic. Animal Crackers was the last movie that they actually was a Broadway play that they converted into a movie. So again, you know, it was between you know Wallace Beery and Richard Bartholomew, and I had Ronald Coleman down for Raffles, but that really wasn't one of his best performances either. So, you know, I looked at it and I said, you know what, I'm going to give just a nod to the Marx Brothers and some of their comedy. I went ahead and gave them the best actors.
You're a good, nice man. Yes. I would pick, I think, I'm looking at 1930. Definitely, I like Norma doing it. You know, 1930 was a funny year, wasn't it? There was like The Big House, Big Pond. I don't know.
It's a weird, like I said, you know, when you look at this, there's not a whole lot of choice there.
Nah, nothing I really like, nothing that really moves me. And I've seen so many of these movies, but I have to. What is his name? I love the guy who does Precode.com. I want to give him a shout out. What's his name? Danny. Danny from Precode.com. I love you. You do the most wonderful, wonderful stuff. And I love your reviews. They're wonderful.